Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. As I said before, it's another fine day here in Ohio. The temperature won't decide what the hell it wants to do. How are we doing today?
It's all good, but yes, I'm down here. You're up north. I'm down south. We can all get along to some degree because we're from Ohio, but we both know that an Ohio Civil War is also inevitable at some point.
Well, I have the luxury of not being from Ohio. I just happen to settle here.
Oh, man. So, yeah, you got no attachment. You can be like, just hey, whatever happens, happens, y'all.
Right. Well, for those who don't know, Joe here is a comic book creator. I stumbled across his book, Death, 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 on Twitter, and was very interested in it. The art style was absolutely right up my alley. And I'm kind of interested in what kind of person ends up creating that. Like, as I said in the pre-interview, to me, it's got this like Super Jail meets Hellraiser kind of quality, what I was looking at. But then also the pages definitely all had their own interesting differences to them too. Nothing was all the same across the board.
Well, yeah, the it's like I have a style and a look I'm going for, but at the same time, I don't want like such a level of consistency where it's like the hatch style is the same no matter what I'm drawing or the texture. Like I mix it up where some artists get stuck in like, here's what works for me. I try to just keep trying things to see what turns out well, just from like an artsy-fartsy aspect. But yeah, it's the book's basically, it's like a mix of like Bible lore, and I'd say just for like pop culture reference, like Berserk and Transformers. Like it's this weird mix of Bible lore, giant organic mechs, and you know, some sword play here and there. You know, it's a sci-fi fantasy, so you can have technology and guns and magic and supernatural all within the same, you know, world. A lot almost like He-Man in a way. You know, it kind of melded all those things where you had wizards right alongside, like, you know, a dude driving a tank with a laser cannon on top. So, and there were kings and queens and knights, yet they had tanks. So it's in that vein of the sense of the archaic's not off limits just because you're looking at a world with a lot of technology at the same time.
Well, that was I've talked about it on the show before. That was always my favorite part about the Dark Tower series with Stephen King, is because you have this world where like Roland's the gunslinger, but he grew up in a castle with like the wizard Merlin.
Yeah, it's so weird. Yeah,
and at the same time, like there's like these hyper technological parts of the world, the beams and the machines that go through and make the world turn. Like it never decided what it wanted to be, and that was why I loved it so much. It's like, one minute you're reading a Louis L'Amour novel, and the next thing you know, you're reading Wizard in Glass, which is, frankly, the Wizard of Oz.
I'll say this, and this isn't like a toot my own horn, but to my own credit, I guess I'll say, like, I tried to intentionally keep the, like, let's say characters that were tech savvy compared to characters that wouldn't be, clearly coming from worlds where it's obvious that they don't know about this stuff yet till they bump heads, you know, and that's how they. The characters that aren't tech savvy discover what that is. And the ones that are now getting a little throwback to a more savage time by who they're meeting. So there's basically three core factions in the story. There is a planetary system called the Blood System, where like a renegade angel basically is parading as a king. He looks like a giant skeleton. His name's King Blood. And, he's kind of like from one of those areas where it's that mix of all of it. You get a little bit of tech, a little bit of archaic, so you can have spaceships right next to castles type stuff. And then your other factions are more of like these savage beasts from the wild that don't know technology. And then you've got the middle ground characters that are almost pure technology by the time they run in. So you have the magic, the archaic and savage, and the tech kind of all meeting in one big territorial war. Because most of it's a war book. It's a family book mixed with a war book. It focuses around a family caught in the midst of it, but you're also getting the story of what's happening in the war simultaneously, but through their eyes in a lot of ways.
There's something about that, I think, that draws us. Because, I mean, I look back at some of my favorite X-Men episodes back in, you know, X-Men 94, whatever it was. They were all the ones in the Savage Lands where you've got freaking dinosaurs and beasts around. And meanwhile, Mr. Sinister is up in the castle with all of his hyper high technology fusing beasts together and creating monsters. And it's like, there's something just, I don't know, maybe primally interesting about that. Maybe it's like the where we come from, where we go.
Well, I think too, when people can pull it off, when it's done well, it works. When it's done badly, it's really bad. It's like you don't have a lot of room for error with this stuff. So it's like, you draw inspiration from things like that. You know, you look at the guys that did do it well, your Chris Claremont's, endless amounts of manga and anime creators and stuff. You know, Anno's Evangelion. It was this weird mix of supernatural, yet they were aliens, yet there was biblical prophecy being fulfilled, yet giant mech, you know?
Yeah, I still can't wrap my head around that entire thing.
Yeah, it's just super weird, and that's part of what makes it cool. Is that you're made uncomfortable by weird imagery. It's not necessarily always gruesome. It's just weird. Weird sounds, weird stories, characters that are where their personalities are defined enough that you can kind of tell like who's, like Evangelion just did such a good job of basically like taking like a psychology book and opening it up and being like, here's a character, he's going to have mommy problems. This character is going to have uncle problems. And they just figured out how to make the personalities fit so well that they were all really defined on what their hangups and quirks were.
In the same genre, I think back to like one of my favorite animes from back in the day, Trigun. And for me, it was the idea that like, okay, there's these two brothers and they're technically plants. Like they look like people, but they're really next generation vegetables. I'm having difficulty with this one, but it was great.
Yeah, well, there's so much competition in Japan in terms of being creative and standing out with something different that, like, yeah, it may take like a zillion manga to get that one awesome one, but that one awesome one, man, it leaves an impression on people forever. And I think that's part of what I'm trying to do with Death, Death, Death is give people a story that will leave like a lasting impression. So, you know, I want it to go on for a while. I want it to be this kind of long running thing, get at least like 8 to 10 volumes total to make it a finished, you know, story complete in terms of like characters living out their life. And then, you know, it's just over. They're done. They're dead. Whatever. So
how did you get into, you know, I guess, you know, creating your own manga? You're not a Japanese person, not over there, not part of that culture. You're here in America. Why is that the medium that you chose to like go down the path with, and how did you get there?
Well, I was raised on Western comics, but I had the obscure luxury growing up of every one of my family members being military people. So we would get things back from like Germany and Japan being the dominant places because they were mostly Marines. They were almost all stationed in one or the other. You know, we didn't get stuff from Korea or Guam. It was always Japan or Germany. So I would get like weird Disney comics in German that looked strange. They weren't even fun to look at. They were just awful. But I would get these, you know, Dragon Ball Z, like bootleg VHS tapes occasionally, or like they would bring back just weird toys and weird comics. You know, Japan is, they love their monsters and all that kinds of stuff. So they're usually grabbing like really cheap stuff, but it gave me just a little taste of Japanese entertainment at a young age. And by the time the mid-90s, it was finally starting to get easier to get a hold of, not so much manga, but at least like anime was becoming commonplace at mall video stores, and cable was running a lot more of that kind of stuff. So it had a big influence on me, despite the fact that I grew up with Western comics, because even though I love superhero comics, I love DC comics, like they're, well, I did, I don't so much these days, but at one point in my life, that was the universe. I love the fatherly DC universe of characters. And I loved, you know, the X-Men and Spider-Man and all your typical Marvel stuff, too. And some indie stuff. But, you know, when I was growing up, I was a little too young to really, like, for that to catch my eye the same way as all these colorful, you know, Marvel and DC books on a shelf. But as I got older and I put in the desk hours of drawing comics and being like, this is all I plan on doing with myself in life. Inevitably, you get bored and you get tired of what you're looking at, too. You start to revert back to other things you remember being cool. And eventually I started to revert back to anime and manga and be like, you love that stuff your whole life. You phased out of it for maybe like 6 years. Just go back and try to get back into that. You're getting bored with just picture of Batman standing. You know, like it's great when you're like a learning artist and you're growing up and you're trying to get better with anatomy. But it's like, I've already seen it for like 30 years. I'm tired of it now. So what I did was I just kind of drew inspiration from all the stuff I liked, whether it was Akira or Berserk or X-Men or, you know, the more wholesome DC kind of era stuff, and kind of worked that all into one comic book of the story I've been wanting to tell forever. But I couldn't, because the things I wanted to use for it were all owned by somebody else. So eventually I was like, you just have to find a way to tell the story using all your own characters. And it's not like I was foreign to using my own characters. I just already had like an idea in my head. So once I snapped out of that and got it together, I started working on Death, Death, Death prior to it having a name. Probably in like 2014, 15, I really started to lay the groundwork for it and do design work and things like that. And eventually when it got to the point where I had like a good enough idea of the story to go ahead and start drawing artwork, I probably worked on it for about a year in between like paid gigs. And that allowed me to, when I did the Indiegogo campaign, to at least be a little ahead. Like, I'm still, you know, a little late right now, but it's also a massive, it's a 300 page book. I draw it, I color it, I letter it. The only thing I don't do is 100% of the editing, because that wouldn't make sense. Like, the whole point of an editor, someone else reads it. So
it's the eyes. When your eyes are used to looking at something, like, they're used to it and they don't notice anything.
You're 100% correct, man. Like, I've got three editors that have each been doing run throughs on like 50 page chunks at a time. And we all keep missing little things. It's your brain starts to read and it fills in those gaps, even if a word's not there. And it's difficult, because even the best of the best miss some stuff. And it's like, I don't mind like a few little things here and there. Like, no one's gonna notice like two or three grammar errors in the entire book unless they're just really anal retentive about that stuff.
I'm into copywriting. That's one of my interests, and I still send my copy to other people to look at, because, like, you know, one of our things we're always harping on is, you know, you want to give the benefit, not the feature. And following that logically, like, your brain does jumps where, like, you feel like you're giving a benefit, but if you keep following, like, but no, that's not really what the benefit is. That's still a feature, and this is really the benefit that thing's giving. But your brain just automatically does the jump and like makes you think it's the thing, because it's just doing the work for you and doesn't want you to waste the energy getting there. It's wild how it works like that.
Well, it is, because we know it's going to happen, but we can't necessarily control it in the midst of it, especially when you get settled in and you start working. You know what I mean? It's like you get a flow. And I think when people are in the zone or they get a flow going, it's almost easier to miss something, because you're enjoying your work. You're moving good. You feel the progress being made. So it's one of those things where that's one of my biggest regrets, is I didn't equate editing time in the fulfillment time, like, in my head, because I've been drawing comics and commercial art and a bunch of stuff like that, graphic design, since like 2002. So my whole life has been, you draw page, either pencil or ink or color, or whatever, then you hand pages in and you move on with your life. You know, once you do your gig and you get paid, then it's on to the next thing. You got to make money. And that's how my brain thought.
This would be in the boss as its own thing, huh? Where you're the guy who's the next step, too.
Yeah. And honestly, like, me and my business partner, Shane Mess, at King Toad, our studio, we've both ran, like, comic book shops we used to own. stuff like that. We tried other endeavors in between of trying to reach our creative goals. Like, well, you know, that's still a big part of being involved. Let's open stores, things like that. So I was kind of used to some of it there, but the catch was like, I just did not equate the time it takes to read and reread and read and reread and fix errors and do corrections and keep sifting through these. Like, I even have to break the files down into like smaller chunks of pages. Like, if I open up my drive to like the folder that just says death, 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 I just see like hundreds of pages and I'm like, ah, good Lord, I'm going to have to, I got to simplify this. I got to make this easier to attack because like, it's just so much. So it's overwhelming, even though I did it to myself. I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. I made the call to do it this way.
So we've talked about like how your Indiegogo's taking a long time on the fulfillment side of things. I'm curious how that works, being that you've gone that route. Most people kind of are figuring 6 months, and then like I get a product like a month or two after it, all the campaign ends. This has been an ongoing thing now for a while, from what I gathered.
Yeah, I don't know about for every type of crowdfund, but we'll say comic books specifically, just because that's the one I know the best. Yeah, and I mean, I'd say since the beginning of people crowdfunding comics back in, I don't know, when that started to become a thing around like 2013, you started to see it kick up a little more. Like, it was a thing prior, but you started to see more people doing it. And in those days, if you hit, like, if you weren't an established guy from a bigger publisher, just hitting $8,000 was, like, a huge deal. And now, these days, that's looked at as, like, that'll be just enough to get through. I may even have to use some of my own money. So those days are kind of gone in terms of people looking at that as like a success. It's still good if you're new. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's bad. If your product's a dollar a piece, that means you got 8,000 people to sign up. It just depends on a bunch of other variables. But it has been an issue.
Well, it all depends on what you're defining success as for any campaign.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Just getting a page done is success.
Is this a marketing campaign where I want to get known? Or is this like a thing where I'm trying to make money off of it? Sometimes it's worth it to take the hit to establish that brand and start building off of something with some people in there.
There's nothing that a person can be passionate about they're not going to have to make sacrifices for, ultimately. I think every creative, no matter what field of creative they're in, knows that, especially after they've done it for at least a year. They all know this.
Well, my favorite story in that was I remember reading an article once that the Flaming Lips had in their business model that they had to sell 3 songs per album for commercial use to be able to afford going on tour because of how like expensive touring is for them.
I believe that.
And it's like you do the business you do so that you can do what you want to do. And however that shakes out, you find a way to make it work.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's, we're in this new era too, where like younger people are starting to realize that it's not, you don't have to so much be worried about selling out. It sounds bad on paper saying the words, but the reality is it's called earning a living within the realms of the thing you excel at. And sometimes you're going to have to do it on things you don't necessarily enjoy, just like at a normie job where you're going to have to do things you don't enjoy every single day. Even if you like your job, there's going to be rough days, good days and bad days.
Well, I used to have a buddy who'd give me shit because like I'd play in cover bands and whatnot. And it's like, go show me the part-time job where I can show up, make $20 an hour and drink while I'm doing it and practice guitar. Like if you find me that job, I'll take it. But that's this job.
And honestly, if you're playing in a bar, it's not that you can't throw your own songs in, but people like what they recognize in those environments. It's like, hey, I'm trying to make the people that showed up here are perfectly happy with me playing cover songs and making money at it. You know why? Because they all want to kind of get a little drunk and shake a little bit to something they recognize. You know.
Well, and you understand what your job is on a Friday night. It's to help people sell drinks. That's it. That's what your job is in that situation.
Yeah, your job is to give them a good time with your music. And if that's covers,
Maybe it's not creatively rewarding, but that's your job.
At least that's a realm where there's so much music. Let's just say like between like classic rock and metal, that people recognize at this point, that you can at least switch it up a lot. You know, there's so many songs, you know.
Oh, dude, I was doing Fleetwood Mac covers next to my Chemical Romance covers. I was having a blast.
That's awesome, though. See, that's sweet. Because, you know, like, My Chemical Romance has now had enough time that they're the epitome of their era and their type of music. Like, they're always going to... It's like Metallica to metal. They're always going to be the guys that popularized it. Even though they weren't the first, they made it global. My Chemical Romance did the same thing for emo, and they will always be able to there's always going to be a whole generation of people that look at them fondly, no matter how old they get.
And Fleetwood Mac. So,
well, my biggest frustration is that bar owners and the booking agents haven't caught up to the fact that that's where we are musically, and they're still booking the same Tom Petty tributes.
You know, I believe that. That's some boomer shit right there.
Don't get me wrong. I can play it, but I'd rather play the stuff that my generation likes, and we're the ones spending money in bars.
Well, that's what those guys don't realize. You guys are. You're at that age now where My Chemical Romance is their Tom Petty. It's like, that's what you grew up on. Now, this is what these people grew up on. You need to realize that.
That's you know, Tom Petty's what my dad listened to, and I listen.
Tom Petty's so old, you guys. You don't even realize.
Well, it's that's officially oldies now. Like, it's,
it is.
What is it? Nirvana became classic rock 15 years ago.
Dude, it's so weird. Like, the oldies station here when I was growing up in Cincinnati as a little kid played like doo-wop, maybe the Beatles, and was as far as it went. You know, Elvis, a lot of Four Tops, a lot of Motown stuff.
Yeah. I love all that stuff, but...
Me too, it's great, but now it's all...
It's classical now.
Yeah, exactly. I turn the same station on now, and they're playing the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, and Led Zeppelin, and I'm just like... And they're like, oldies, 103.5. I'm like, Jesus Christ, Fleetwood Mac's the oldies. Now, it used to be groups from the 50s and the 60s, Mac. You didn't touch the 70s. What is happening?
So we've been talking about Indiegogos and building an audience. What are the big things that you've found have been helped you be successful as far as building an audience goes in your career?
Well, it's kind of a mix of things. I was kind of in the right place at the right time in terms of when comic books was having their customer revolt. So when they were having theirs, I had just closed up my last comic book shop. I was over that side of it. It was like, you know what? This is no different than like working at Walmart. And I don't mean that in a degrading way. I mean that in like, I might as well just go work at Walmart, not have the hassle of trying to run a business at the same time. Because it's the same job. It's just one place sells comics and toys, and video games. The other place also has clothes and groceries. So it wasn't fulfilling is my point. It was awful. And it was one of those things where I was like, I'm not cut out for this. I'm too old now.
Well, and you said you're doing this at a time where there's an upheaval in the fandom. So I imagine that's and there's probably a time where there was a lot of camaraderie amongst the people involved in that community. And now we're watching the whole community kind of fracture apart.
Oh yeah, it was, man. And it was weird because it was like a mishmash of the political times of, what do they call it? Like Dynasty comic books being ruined. The people being put in charge of them having zero respect for the characters, their history, people that worked on it prior. So we were seeing established Dynasty things being smashed and ruined in real time. And it was this slow build from around like 2013. You started seeing it, these like retailer events that the distributors for comics and pop culture stuff would put on. Like, and it was only shop owners that would be invited to these things. Like, these shop owners were enraged. Like, they were screaming these people down. Like, it was getting to a point where it was...
I can't sell this stuff. Nobody wants it.
Yeah, it was getting bad, man. And I was kind of dipping out right about then. So I was kind of like in, like, I don't care mode. But I stumbled across this guy on YouTube. At the time, he was called Diversity in Comics. It was kind of a joke name. But now he's known as Comics Matter with you boys at. And he was pointing out all these issues. And subsequently, because he was the only person verbalizing it and being honest about it, and he was tactful. People act like he was mean and terrible and awful. It's like, not really. He's about as calm, down to earth as they come, just a super normie. He spurred off the kind of the customer revolt in comics, and had a huge community drawn to him because of that. And that allowed guys like me that have been trying to get in that door my whole life. And then the minute I'm good enough to get in that door, the door is closing now because the business is falling apart. It's not because I can't cut it. It's because there's no jobs, because it's not making any money, and they'll only hire people to work for peanuts. So it hurt knowing that I was watching this thing I grew up on and I loved and wanted to do my whole life just being destroyed, and now it's down to just indie comics. Well, the thing was, that's like that blessing in disguise where there's, you know, it's dark in the tunnel, but there's a light at the end. At the end of it, indie comics turned out to be the answer. So now there was this groundswell of people just looking for good comics. And it allowed me to kind of get into, I wouldn't say the groups, but allowed me to network easily, you know, because there were people seeking it out on Twitter and Facebook and the different social platforms.
It's the same thing that happened to music 20 years earlier. Like when studio stuff started getting real cheap because the technology got cheap, like you started being able to buy interfaces for a couple $100 instead of 10, 20 grand. Guys in their garages and basements said, oh, if I don't need to go to a studio, I can crank out records myself. I always cite the very first All-American Rejects record. These two dudes made that thing in a basement and sold it to a major label. And that's, to me, that's amazing. And the idea is, like, you're going to get, like, you're going to get an honesty that you don't get out of people, like, which makes more sense now, where since we can all go to our own fan bases, we can go find the people that resonate. We're not the idea, in my opinion, having followed, you know, mass media for 30 years now, the big thing is the rock stars are dead. The idea of superstars in general are dead. The musicians I grew up with are probably like the last of the really iconic people. There's a certain degree of it, I guess, maybe in like the YouTube, Twitch space where you have like over the top large creators. But that's, even that I don't think is going to last forever. It's, I think it's because they're new media. Niche marketing, niche, you know, audiences is a thing. And I hearken back to the idea of like the 1,000 true fans model. Like if you can find 1,000 people that'll resonate with what you do, then you're going to be fine for the rest of your life. Like that can support you.
You keep those 1,000 people happy, you can have a comfortable middle-class life, raise your kids, give them a good upbringing, comfortable lifestyles. Yeah.
And the problem is you've got companies like DC, Marvel, that they're selling only those numbers of like units, but they're trying to maintain these huge corporate entities on the same fan bases as, you know, and it's because a particular niche essentially took over those particular companies, and they're marketing, they're doing niche marketing like everybody else, but their business model can't sustain it.
Are you familiar with Finn McKenty?
I've been a fan of Finn for years.
Okay. I like Finn a lot too. I find him very insightful and realistic with expectations.
I disagree with him a lot, but like,
oh, me too, but he's
honest.
He is, but he's one of those guys where it's like, even when he's wrong, there's like, there's a nugget of like, you got to give it to him on certain things. But he was actually talking about something like this not too long ago, in terms of like that last era of superstars, and that last era, and it really was the My Chemical Romance, the Paramore, that Fallout Boy. It was that mid-2000s kind of group that all started to fizzle a little bit by like 2010, 2012. But,
and like, I'm old enough, I couldn't tell you a single thing that's popular right now, but it's because I don't think anything's popular like things were popular when I was a kid, because you have the different fan bases.
Yeah, well, he pointed out too, it's one of those things where we went from, we all kind of took in the same TV, the same radio, the same, and he was right, we had what we had, and that's why, like, everyone knows who the Kardashians are, whether you've ever watched an episode or not. You know who Kim Kardashian is. You don't have to have seen her show ever as a normie to know that name 100%, who she is, what she sounds like, etc. And I think he's right. We may not see that again because algorithms and the way we've taken media now is so narrowed down to people's specific taste that we're just not all casually taking in the same stuff any longer. You know, unless you're like a sports fan or something, you know.
Along that vein, where comics are kind of reaching that point now, I've been saying, you know, I remember 20 years ago, people were saying, oh, well, there's no good music out now. And I'm like, there's more good music out now than there's ever been. The problem is that it's you have to go find it. And the thing is, you'll find something more tailored to your particular taste than anything you've ever found before. But it's not going to be broadcast. It's just people out there doing it, and you gotta go find it.
Every time I've heard I was one of those kids too, where when I grew up, I really dove deep into anything I got into. So if I got into Transformers, or if I got into Emperor, some Norwegian black metal band or something, I would want to learn everything about that particular thing. The band members' names, the amount of times band members have changed in the group, when the records were released, how long they'd been around, anything they did prior to their bigger signings, anything they recorded in a basement when they were 12. Like, I just enjoyed learning about things I was into. And luckily, I learned about tons and tons of stuff just during my teens. But I understand now in my life now, it is hard to go out and just seek things out and find things because people get so bogged down.
I got a wife and kid, man. I don't have any time to do shit.
You know what I'm talking about then. There's a point where it's I don't know when I'm going to sleep. There's no hours left in the day. Once I do this, and this, and I get the things I want to be doing with myself out of the way, plus what I have to do, there's no time left. So it's tough. Because we don't have that common media to make superstars, but we have the luxury that you can make it in the niche realm or even blow up from there, just depending on how you're doing it. And in terms of networking, before I forget this, I just to be realistic with your audience, for me, when I discovered a large swath of comic book fans that were all cohesive and you could kind of speak to them all together, whether it was on Twitter or wherever, the people gathered. For comic books, it's tough because you have to try to hit a bunch of audiences that don't necessarily know or care about comics. So what you'll do is you'll end up indirectly or directly making connections with people that are at least in the realm. So even if they're just a funny YouTube creative that also talks about movies, you try to get on, you try to meet these people, get to know these people, and it can take a while in some cases because they're pretty busy people too. Most of them have wives and kids and lives to maintain, and even if YouTube's their job, they've got to try to answer the 10,000 emails and the 10,000 requests to can I come on your show? Can I be on your show? So what I did was I just took the gradual approach of you don't suck up to them, but you're nice to them, at least in the public ways, and you try to interact and get to know different people. And then in time, it will work its way to where you'll get to know them even more, where they'll be comfortable around you because they've seen your name or your face and your words on a screen hundreds and hundreds of times, and now they feel at least a little closer to you.
Sounds an awful lot like relationship building. that's what I boil everything down to in marketing. It's all about building relationships.
It is. That's, and I'll tell you this. Well, the little realm of Comicsgate, I jumped into that day one because it was a consumer movement and it hadn't been too much turned into a political thing yet. Obviously a lot of the people in it were right-leaning.
Well, I did notice that you've been very, very coy about using that word even in this show. It's come up as a consumer revolt a few times, but I get what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, some people act like it's something weird or scary, and it's not. It's just a bunch of disgruntled people that used to love buying comics that now hate comics, mainstream books, because they're awful. But they want to love them. That's the catch. They want to love them. They're not being allowed to. But even in that little realm, it took me, I'd say, about 5 or 6 years of getting to know everyone in it. Some of them I already knew just from the comic book world, conventions, and you meet people over time when you're doing indie gigs and working on comics. So, some people I already knew, some I was getting to know. And over time, it took me probably, about 4 to 6 years to really build that into a big network where I know there's guys with huge platforms I can go to anytime if I really need them, and they're not going to say no to me.
I need to do my press release and get this out as quickly as possible, as many people as I can. Can you help?
And they know I don't have time to do YouTube full time like they do. I'm so bogged down with work, I can't commit to anything else that would be to my own detriment. I can't focus on comics, running this business, getting the products made, taking care of my kids, and paying my bills, and doing the paid work I have to do that.
But you love it, right?
Yeah, and make good YouTube videos. Something's got to give in there. So luckily, those guys like me enough to where we're now friends in a lot of ways, to where it's easier for me to go to them and say, hey, brother, I never ask you for anything. I mean, you know, just hook me up, help me out. You know, if you need something that's within my capability, I will reciprocate. And a lot of times you don't even have to go that far. You just do it because you're all buddies. But it's that helps too. That's one of the big things. But at the same time, I don't want people to think it's all about YouTube, because if your work ain't good, if you're not making quality books, or if your writing is subpar, if your writer or your artwork looks like shit, you can't get upset when people are harder to network with. But that's because your product's somewhat a bit of a representation of yourself. And if the product looks dumpy and bad, even if, let's say, parts of it are good, they can't read your mind. They don't know that. So it's a patience game. It's getting to know people, going to events they're going to be at, meeting them and being polite and giving them some stuff too, so they remember you. It's a bunch of little things that add up, you know.
Well, you were saying that one of the things I think that is more important to realize now, because everything has been democratized so much, people that probably they haven't reached that point where they're really skilled yet, have the ability to go and compete in the same field and don't get noticed, because the bottom line is they haven't done the work to get where they have to get to actually produce the quality of material that they want, you know, and it looks less than in the eyes of the media, and they're not going to get the audience they want, but they still need to start. They still need to do their thing and understand who they are.
Yeah. There's nothing I can stress more than trying to be realistic with ourselves, as tough and frustrating as that can be at times. Cause I mean, I would say at least once a month, maybe I try to like really look at myself and be like, am I the problem with this thing? Or is this thing the problem and I need it? Like, I try to object, like really look at things and make sure it's not just me being an idiot or doing something wrong before I assume the worst of other things. You know, it's kind of like,
did I immediately get shadow banned, or do I not know what the hell I'm doing this month?
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, it's like that thing where you'll hear techie guys say this, like, it's not the computer, it's the user. And I think sometimes that is the case, and that's hard to accept, because like, I'm not the most entertaining guy. I can get by on some streams and do okay and have good banter. But like, there's also nights where I'm beat, dude. I ain't got an ounce of life left in me, and I'll still try to make a show or do something and be like, this audience is new to me, and they're all going to think I'm just quiet and stupid and I got nothing to say. But it's just because I'm fighting to get through this. So,
well, I have the distinguished position of having actually fallen asleep on a podcast before.
It's easy to do sometimes.
Just kind of edged my way out of frame and let everybody else talk, kept the camera off me. It was a long weekend.
Yeah. Well, dude, it's just how it is. Like, if you want to do anything in life that you care about, it's going to be a grind. And even if you get the success you want, now the new grind is maintaining that and then moving it up if that's your desire. So it's difficult, because even if you're making a lot of money, it doesn't mean that money will stretch out into employees and everything else if you're trying to have long-term people to help ease the load. Like, it's, you got to accept a lot of tough realities as you go on any creative endeavor. Like, if I can outsource some work, I do, but there's really not much I can short of like the literal printing. And like, I don't have the money yet to afford the payrolls for people to do this stuff for me.
Well, and that's why one of the things I'm excited about is like, there's more people like me. Or I'm not a comic book creator. I fancy myself a writer sometimes, but I'm not really a writer. But I love what other people are doing. And, you know, I have my skill set in marketing, and I'm looking to help as many people as I can realize, you know, take some of the burden off of what they're doing to allow them the time to do what they're really good at and not have to worry about the other stuff. That ecosystem and like the way it used to be there, the big industrial scale isn't there yet. But the more people develop each different part of that cottage industry in this new ecosystem, is just going to mean more people are able to go out and thrive without having to take on the burden of being a comic book printer at the same time as you're the comic book creator, things like that. And I, you know, 10 years from now, I have all faith that this is going to be a thriving system as much as it can, given, you know, broader economic situations, we'll just say.
Well, I think part of it too is like, you're seeing this weird mix right now of people that are like, crowdfunding shouldn't be the way to go long term. And then you'll see other people that are like, I don't know, I'm fine with just crowdfunding long term. Like, what's the issue? Why should I try to do it other ways. And it's like, once you start looking at the tax benefits and things like that of it, you start to understand that this is why people just want to solely stick with crowdfunding. Because if you're like I've got a website being built right now, it's nearly done. It'll have a store and all that stuff on it where we can resell our products. I have to pay sales tax on everything that sells over there. Money I get from Indiegogo is like a donation. It's like capital that someone's just giving you to use. There's no sales tax on it because you're not selling people individual units. You're selling them an idea and they're giving you money and you're promising a gift. And that's how the law looks at it. So you see the benefit of it because, yes, if you're paying yourself, yeah, you've got to pay taxes on your personal pay still, obviously. But your business, like I have an S-Corp. The S-Corps don't pay federal tax anyways. It's just how they're set up. So that's not really a worry. I don't ever have to fuss with federal. I have to file it, but I don't, you know, there's never any money, no matter how much I make going to them. But on the state level and the local level, you can still get a lot of money eaten up from you if you're talking, I sold units and made money on them. Where if people are just giving you capital and you're giving them a gift.
Now you need to be a tax expert too, bro?
Yeah, you got, dude, I've been doing my own business taxes for years now. It's terrible and I hate it. And it makes me miserable for like a fucking week straight. But you learn a lot of things along the way of why people do things. Like I didn't even know that initially. I was reporting our first two Indiegogo runs as like, you know, money made and paying in tons of extra that I didn't need to pay that wasn't necessary. And I guess I could go back if I really wanted to be nitpicky and try to like.
Oh, yeah, and trigger the audit, right?
These old ones. Yeah, but like, who wants to do all that shit? Like, it's one of those things where the reason people want success and they want money, it's not just for, let's say, frivolous things we want in our life or petty things that we just want the money to buy. A lot of it's because it just offers you a certain level of convenience because other people can now do things for you that are terrible pain in the ass, and these people are specialists, and that's what they do for a job, so they're more than happy to take your money to do it. And it allows you a little more freedom and less weight on a person's shoulders in their daily lives. So, like, I get the crowdfunding model. I totally understand why people do it. I'm trying to find, like, a middle ground where I can still resell stuff but still have some capital coming in from the crowdfund side of it, where it's like we have you have a little extra wiggle room. Maybe it's not millions of dollars of wiggle room, but I mean, thousands is still pretty nice. You know, it's still to know you can make a $5,000 error and you'll survive it. You know, is a nice feeling to have. You don't want it to happen, but it's like, hey, at least I know we won't, like, you know, we'll still be able to get our books printed if there's some huge screw up or something terrible happens, you know. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me today.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Joe, I think there was a lot of good stuff in there for people that are new to doing this. Maybe some hard truths to swallow, but a lot of hope that if you do the right stuff, like it's also not impossible. Like that's always the big thing, is understanding that if you do the work and you stay at it long enough, things are kind of bound to happen to a certain degree.
Yeah, get your feet wet and go to an accountant at first. Or forever, if you can afford it. Yeah.
Right on. Well, you take it easy and have a good one.
You too, brother. Thank you.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironeedsmarketing.com. And let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.